an artistic legacy of Coventry Cathedral.
And it has a message which is as relevant and important today as it was 50 years ago.
The story of Coventry Cathedral in Radio 3's Sunday feature, starting at 7:45.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's just gone 1 o'clock, time for the news from John Shea.
United Nations observers are reported to have arrived in the Syrian town of Hula, where activists say that 90 people were massacred by government forces. Unverified film footage has been published on the internet, which suggests some children were among those killed. The Syrian Opposition Council is calling for the UN Security Council to take action. The Home Office is making contingency plans in case there's an increase in immigrants from the Eurozone if the currency collapses. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, has suggested the number of people coming here could be restricted in special circumstances. Spain's fourth largest bank, Bankia, has been explaining why it needs a €19 billion bailout from the Spanish government. Bankia's chief executive said he had called a news conference in an effort to reassure investors about the company's exposure to bad loans made during Spain's construction boom. State media in Egypt have confirmed the candidates in the country's presidential runoff. Voters will be invited to choose between Mohamed Morsi from the Muslim Brotherhood and Ahmed Shafiq, the last prime minister to serve under President Mubarak. 12 high streets have been chosen to receive about £100,000 each as part of a regeneration programme. The areas chosen include Bedminster in Bristol, Croydon and Market Rasen in Lincolnshire. They'll receive advice from the retail expert Mary Portas. Police in Greater Manchester are investigating the murder of a man shot in a crowded pub. Three others were wounded in the shooting at Droylston. Detectives say the gunman escaped in a car, which was found abandoned a few miles away. There's been another hitch in the restoration of the Staatsoper Unter den Linden in Berlin. Officials say the 19th century building won't now reopen until April 2015. The latest delay is reported to have been caused by the unexpected discovery of some wooden posts under the building. And the weather. It'll remain very warm in the sunshine in most places, but in the far southwest, it'll cloud over this afternoon and there'll be showers this evening. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 1:02.
And now the Early Music Show, presented by Catherine Bott. And today's programme celebrates the centenary of the birth of the countertenor Alfred Deller.
Listening shows me back. 50 years old, that recording of Alfred Deller and Mark Deller singing Purcell's Sound the Trumpet, accompanied by the Oriana Concert Orchestra. Alfred was born 50 years before that, on the 31st of May 1912. And to celebrate the glories of that day, and you've got to stand by now, I've thought of the most ghastly but irresistible Sound the Trumpet-related pun. I'm joined now in the studio by three sprightly haute boys, countertenors all, who need no further introduction. In strictly alphabetical order, they are Robin Blaise, James Bowman and Mark Deller himself. That's one of those recordings you never forget where you were when you first heard it. I was in the music room at my school. What about you, Robin? When did you first hear that Sound the Trumpet?
Well, I think I'm alone and sadly in a minority of one of never actually having heard Alfred live. But I remember about the age of 15 at Uppingham School in the music library and going and looking out CDs of all sorts of countertenors and listening to this and just being knocked out. The quality of the voice, the certainty, the declamation of the text, the beauty of the tone, all those things.
And James Bowman, what struck you about that wonderful recording when you first heard it?
I think the thing that really struck me was the fact that how similar in many ways their voices were. It was extraordinary that father and son should sound quite similar. I'll tell you where I first heard it. It was in Taphouse's record shop in Oxford, alas no more, and I was thoroughly interested to hear this particular recording because I had met Mark and I wanted to hear the two of them together.
Well, now it's Mark's turn.
Well, I mean, I knew the piece quite well, but that was my first recording ever, my first time with the sort of consort, I suppose.
Now, let's move on to the next music. For this centenary celebration of Alfred Deller, all my guests have chosen music for today's programme that represents some facet of his art. James first. James Bowman, tell us about why you want us to hear this duet from Bach's Magnificat.
Well, I've always loved that recording, and I loved Wilfred Brown's voice as well as Alfred's, and the combination of the two was, to me, irresistible. But the point I would love to make at this early stage is the rather iconoclastic observation that in those days, all singers who sang Baroque music wobbled. They had wonderful voices, but they wobbled, and this particular duet is a wonderful illustration of the art of singing beautifully Baroque music and not wobbling. We can hear the note, we can hear the harmonies, we can hear where it's going. It's beautifully phrased. I mean, Wilfred Brown is the most wonderful singer. With Alfred, I think it's the ideal combination, and I think they must have loved singing together.
And it shows.
Yes, I think so.
Oh,
Back to the days of mono recording, Alfred Deller and Wilfred Brown singing the duet Et Misericordia from Bach's Magnificat with the Kalmar Orchestra conducted by Pierre Colombo. We're going to be hearing Alfred Deller singing solo, of course, but one of the most important contributions he made to the early music movement was a pioneering ensemble, his own Deller Consort. Turning to Mark Deller now. Mark, was it the only group of its kind when he founded it?
No, it wasn't the only group of its kind. I think Alfred had sung for a couple of years with the Golden Age singers, all characters. I think Alfred realised quite early on that he really should put together a group of his own that with singers who specialised in that repertoire. And so he formed his own group of singers, the Deller Consort, in 1950. What I think is also quite interesting about that was that the word consort is used all the time nowadays, but I don't think there had been a vocal consort before. And he was one of the first people to use his name, I think, in front of, rather than the English vocal consort or something, to use his name, as indeed adopting the term countertenor rather than alto, you know.
I'm longing to hear this group now.
Yeah.
You've chosen a recording from the early days, but not the earliest days. You've chosen Wilby's Sweet Honeysucking Bees.
Actually, looking back on the Madrigal repertoire and the singing of that, I mean, styles have changed so much. And I thought, oh, my God, when I go back to listen to these, you know, am I going to find anything that I enjoy listening to? But I was quite surprised, going back to the early first 10, 15 years of the group, how good some of those were. And I thought Sweet Honeysucking Bees, which is, of course, an extremely well-known madrigal, but very, very good it is too.
Still not us. So beware,
The Della Consort singing Wilby. Eileen Poulter and Mary Thomas, Alfred Della, Wilfred Brown and Gerald English, and Maurice Bevan. Names to conjure with. Robin Blaise, you're a bit too young to have worked with Della. You've already outed yourself as not having heard him live, but you've chosen a recording from the year 1950 of Alfred singing Dowland, and it's his core countertenor repertory.
The thing that really, I think, strikes me about Alfred is that reading about it, in fact, he was sometimes pulled up by critics for being too expressive with things like rhythms and pulling the time around. And nowadays, we look at these songs and this repertoire, and it's second nature to do exactly what he was doing. And he led the way. And I don't know whether his legacy is celebrated enough for that, actually, that stylistically, just from a personal point of view, he put this kind of music making into it. It wasn't necessarily as a result of having spent years and years going into research or anything like that. He just felt the music to be a living, breathing thing. And so when he felt that there had to be something done with lute songs and something expressive with text, with dynamic, even with tempo, he wasn't frightened to do that. And Ian Partridge always calls this song the perfect setting of English songwriting. And I think that Alfred singing it is just about as good as it gets.
Darkness, let me
Alfred Della and Desmond Dupre with Dowland's song In Darkness Let Me Dwell. When your father, Mark, was starting out, who taught him about countertenor technique?
Nobody. There was nobody. Even when I started to sing, I mean, he didn't like teaching a lot, Alfred, and I don't think I really had a lesson from him ever. No, I think in Alfred's day, I mean, even when I came to be singing, I couldn't go to the college or the academy. They wouldn't take countertenors. We weren't accepted as singers at all.
Did your father ever say that he'd felt like a lone voice crying in the wilderness when he was young?
I don't think he did. You see, it all happened rather dramatically and quickly just after the war. Along came the BBC Third Programme. Alfred had just made a name for himself in 1944, just to the end of the war, singing Purcell for Tippett in London. So he was invited to do the broadcast for the Third Programme. And when the consort was formed, there were no other groups like that around, so they also got a lot of airtime. At the same time, there were an influx, if I can put it like that, of BBC producers who were back from the war, academics, the people like Dennis Stevens, the Thurston Darts, you know, the John Stevenses, all those sort of people coming, Basil Lamb, and pulling out dozens and dozens of programmes of interesting music. So, I mean, Alfred was not an academic, he'd be the first to say that, but he was presented with loads of material that people wanted performed.
Could I find it terribly moving, the fact that he came from not a very musical background, did he?
Not a musical background.
But he just had this extraordinary, unerring feel for the music. He just knew how to do it. It's extraordinary that he had it without thinking about it.
Well, we've discussed Bach, we've had Purcell, we've had consort music, we've had quintessential Dowland, and of course you countertenors, you're cropping up in opera everywhere. The next music is a mad scene from Handel's Orlando.
Oh, wonderful, yes.
Yes, now you've...
One of the great...
You've made that quite a feature of your career.
I've sung it quite a lot, and it's jolly hard work, yes.
This is Ars Tige Larvae, the mad scene from his opera Orlando. Alfred Della and the Handel Festival Orchestra, conducted by Anthony Lewis.
Ars Tige Larvae, asce laratis petri, la perfida donna a rascandette perché a mio mar affesso a mio giusto mar la rendette Stigia barca di Carrante a dispetto già son condannato. Il
Alfred Deller going mad in a scene from Handel's Orlando. Our next music is more from the Deller consort. So coming back to you, Mark, was there any opposition? We're so far hearing about what a pioneer your father was, how exciting it must have been, what all these terrific singers wanting to join in. But was there a groundswell of, you know, this shouldn't be done or this isn't right? Did anybody disapprove?
Oh, tremendous lot, I think, to the voice and to him as a countertenor. Not so much, I think, about the ensemble when you're talking about the consort. That was a slightly dim. They could sort of tolerate that. But, you know, he was beginning to muscle in on all the repertoire which previously had been sung by ladies for such a long time, and to take back, if I can put that, some of the work which strictly should have been done by male altos or countertenors. Yeah. Terrific lot of opposition, both amongst singers, but also amongst orchestral players, I think, as well.
Talking about opposition and controversy, there was a lot of confusion because there had been, in the 18th century, the castrato, not just sopranos singing some of Alfred's repertoire. I believe there is a story of a woman actually saying, possibly as a compliment to your father, you are a eunuch.
Yes, it happened in Germany, and she came up after the concert and said, Mrs. Adela, you are absolute eunuch. And he smiled at her and said, I think you mean unique. And she said, yeah, eunuch. That was the story.
And in case you've just tuned in, this is the Early Music Show, and with me, Catherine Bott, to talk about and to celebrate Alfred Deller in his centenary year are James Bowman, Robin Blaise and Mark Deller himself. Mark, I think we should talk now briefly about a festival, while we're on anniversaries and celebrations. The Stur Festival is 50 years old this year.
Yes, Stur Music, founded back in 1962 by Alfred. Initially, really, just as a vehicle, as we all do, musicians, give ourselves some concerts, some platform. In those days, there wasn't much for early music, let's face it. Alfred had already become quite a big name internationally, so he had the benefit of being able to call on quite a lot of musicians. Nicholas Harnoncourt, Concertus Musicus came over, Collegium Arium from Cologne, and Gustav Leonhardt, late lamented Gustav Leonhardt, of course, in those early days. They all came, you know, for pittance of fees, really, just to come and have a good time and to enjoy the puddings at Stur Music. And most of the people in the early music scene since, for the last 50 years, have come down to Kent in the summer and enjoyed the festival, which takes place each June. Yes, our 50th anniversary, Alfred's centenary the month before, and so, happily, 50 years of Stur and 100 years of him.
James and Robin, can you give me a one-word soundbite on Stur Music?
Friendly.
Okay, friendly.
One word, surprising.
Friendly and surprising and 50 years old this year. We're going to hear some Gesualdo now from the Deller consort. This is a bit of a departure from the sweetness of honey-sucking bees and Elizabethan England. This is Moro Lasso. And after we've heard it, I'll give you the lineup.
Thank you.
A slightly different lineup for the Della Consort on that recording of Gesualdo's Moro Lasso. Mary Thomas and Honor Shepherd, Alfred Della, of course, Robert Teer and Max Worthley, and Maurice Bevan. Some great singing names crop up throughout the life of the Della Consort, don't they, Mark?
They do, and it's lovely to remember them because they were all such... One of the great things about touring with the consort was it, you know, we had such a lot of fun. They were lovely people. I don't think it would have worked and been nearly as enjoyable, you know, if somebody hadn't really fitted in socially and in every other way. Really, really terrific people to remember.
James and Robin, we're going to go back to lute song. Both beautiful singers of lute songs yourselves. What have you learnt from Alfred singing in this repertoire, James?
I think it's something that Robin mentioned earlier about him pulling around the tempo, emphasising certain things, phrasing, rubato, all sorts of little idiosyncrasies. If you sing a lute song utterly straight, it can sound a bit prosaic, but Alfred lifted it into the realm of the exotic and the ethereal, and I think one subconsciously often copies what he used to do. When you sing a song like In Darkness Let Me Dwell, you often think of Alfred when you do it.
Well, Robin, how hard is it to get away from sounding too much like him? Because obviously you want to sound like Robin Blaise.
I think it's almost impossible to sound like him, actually, because I think his voice is so distinctive.
Yes.
And I love the story Bob Spencer told me when I was quizzing him about working with Alfred. And he said that the first time that he went and played for Alfred, Alfred didn't really like rehearsing, but he managed to get him to run through all the songs. He's standing in for Desmond, probably. But he ran through all these songs, much against his better judgment. And so, you know, Bob thought, right, I think that went pretty well, ready for the evening concert. And he said that Mark took him on one side and said, don't be too surprised if it's not exactly the same when it comes to the concert. And sure enough, they got to the performance, everything completely different. So it was great preparation for the evening, and that he knew the wealth of musical ideas, but it was so spontaneous. And so I think to try and imitate it, you know, even Alfred would be different from one performance to the next.
Shall I come, sweet love, to thee when the evening sun is set? Shall I not exclude thee? Will you find
Campion's Shall I Come, Sweet Love to Thee, with Alfred Deller, of course, and Desmond Dupré, this time playing the lute. Our next music features Gustav Leonhardt. I interviewed Gustav for the Early Music Show a year ago, and in passing, he spoke with very warm admiration of Alfred's art. And elsewhere, he's called him not just a singer, which would just imply beautiful voice, but a musician, which is a step higher. Our next music, it's The Plaint from Purcell's Fairy Queen.
The thing that I do really love about this is you can hear there's a massive, long, extended, expansive music list, and he does take it quite slowly. He never once overexerts his influence or his personality on it. He doesn't have to overwork the music, actually. The simplicity he understands, and he just lets the music speak for itself.
Thank you.
Alfred Deller taking the plaint from Purcell's Fairy Queen, and I have to say, making it very much his own. He was accompanied by the Leonhardt Baroque Ensemble, and Mark, Gustav Leonhardt and your father had a very close collaboration, didn't they?
They did, and, you know, the very first recordings he did for Vanguard back in 1954, he enlisted Gustav and Marie Leonhardt and the Harlequins, to Alice as well, to play on that. And I find those particular recordings very, very interesting to hear today because they were pioneer recordings on what we now call authentic instruments, original performances. I mean, it was more than 20 years, really, before it became de rigueur to record this period of music using original instruments.
I think we should end by recalling those amazing improvisatory days. The recording scene, the early music movement is part of the fabric of bourgeois life now. Mm. What have we lost since Alfred's day? I mean, we lost him in 1979.
You have to mention, really, in the same breath, in this sense of exploration with David Munro, those are the white-hot years of the discovery. Mm. And David was a huge admirer of Alfred, enormous admirer of Alfred. And the fact that they both vanished during that period, I mean, the light almost went out, didn't it?
Mm. Yes, 3 years apart.
Yes, it really did.
David very young. And
this idea of this excitement of exploration.
That's right, it's the discovery, isn't it? I think that's what, you know, when Kate alludes to the fact that it's become big business. Mm. Well, it has, and also mainstreamers. But that sense of discovery, no one of my generation can have that same feeling.
It was very exciting.
I mean, in Alfred's heyday, you know, when he was in the prime, he really wasn't earning very much money from it. I mean, when he made his first disc, we didn't have a gramophone, as we call them, in the house. He had to buy a gramophone in order to go and play his own first disc. Do you know, it wasn't till he was over 50 years old that he was brave enough to leave the prop of the choir stall behind, his day job, and felt confident enough to feel that he could support a family.
I always admired John Dyke's power for appointing him to St Paul's because it was such an unusual voice for a cathedral choir, wasn't it? Wonderfully far-sighted of Dyke's power to appoint him.
Yes, yes.
Because it really gave him a platform.
I mean, one of the reasons, it wasn't just that, he was very happy in the camaraderie of the late clerks of the Vicar's Choral and so on, the characters that did, because they were provided an enormous source of many great stories for him, and he was quite a raconteur with Alfred. So, yeah.
Well, I think as we've stopped, you've said an enormous source of great stories. And you three gentlemen have been an enormous source of great stories in celebration of Alfred Deller. I will have to stop and say Mark Deller, James Bowman, Robin Blaise, thank you all very much indeed. And we'll leave the last words and the last notes to Alfred Deller, who was born on the 31st of May, 1912. And here he sings a traditional English evening prayer.
Alfred Deller singing an evening hymn. And it brings to an end today's programme, which was presented by Catherine Bott. And with her were the countertenors James Bowman, Robin Blaise and Mark Deller. Well, from next Monday, you can download a podcast version of that edition. Just go to the Radio 3 website and follow the links to the Early Music Show homepage. In tomorrow's programme, Lucy Skeeping will be presenting highlights of a concert from the early music ensemble L'Estravagante, exploring the art of the violin in Rome and Venice at the turn of the 18th century. That's at the same time, just after 1 o'clock.
We had a little vote on the plane about who had the best food of the 15 capitals that we'd been to.
In the later stages of Maastricht, which lasted 48 hours, most people in the room were asleep, but John Major was not.
I can remember being absolutely determined not to vote for Paris, but Paris won. Copenhagen was second and Dublin was third.
On BBC Radio 4, Jonathan Powell reflects on the decision-making forum of our time.
There isn't a technology yet invented that is a substitute for human beings talking to human beings and finding common solutions.
Summit fever.
You can't just walk away from the table. You know, summits are here to stay.
On Tuesday evening at 8, over on BBC Radio 4.
Well, this is BBC Radio 3. It's time now for another chance to hear last Monday's lunchtime Wigmore Hall concert. The presenter is Katrina Young.
Hello and welcome to the Wigmore Hall. The cellist Johannes Mercer has a reputation for combining rock star energy with real sensitivity and elegance. He's as much at home with the classical repertoire as he is with new ideas. Last year, for example, he gave the premiere of a concerto for electric cello. Today, though, we're on more familiar lunchtime concert territory with Benjamin Britten's cello sonata in C, inspired by Britten hearing the playing of Rostropovich for the first time, and joined today by the pianist Paul Ravinius. They begin with the first of Brahms's two cello sonatas. It's a passionate and romantic work which also pays homage to Bach and Beethoven. When Brahms began writing it in his late 20s, he wasn't yet established as one of Europe's major composers. It took him a few years to finish it, and even then the first publisher he approached turned it down. The sonata finally appeared in Berlin in 1866 and was first performed in Vienna some 8 years later by an amateur cellist, a Viennese doctor to whom Brahms had dedicated the work, with Brahms himself at the piano. And now applause for their 21st century counterparts, Johannes Mercer and Paul Ravinius, coming onto the stage at Wigmore Hall to begin today's lunchtime concert with the cello sonata number 1 in E minor by Brahms.